I'm Manoush Zomorodi, host of the WNYC podcast, Note to Self. I'm sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and you are listening to WNYC.org and WNYC. Okay, so last night, Hillary Clinton made history, becoming the first woman to be the nominee for president of a major political party. And this milestone comes on the heels of last week's controversial Republican National Convention that confirmed Donald Trump as that party's nominee. New Yorker staff writer Ryan Lizza is in Philadelphia covering the Democratic Convention, and he joins us today to discuss both conventions, as well as his recent profile in the latest New Yorker of Gary Johnson and William Weld, the Libertarian Party's most mainstream ticket since its founding. This article is called, In a Bizarre Presidential Race, Gary Johnson Might Actually Have a Shot. It's in this week's issue of the New Yorker, and I am so pleased that it brings Ryan Lizza to our show. Hey, Ryan.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Where are you right now, exactly?
Someone must have told you. I am coming to you live from a bathroom in a suite.
Awesome.
Inside the convention center that CNN International was nice enough to hook me up with. You know, it's not so easy to find a landline these days.
No, that is absolutely true, and very good of you to sequester yourself in there. We're going to make Ryan...
And so if I suddenly get cut off, it's because someone has tripped over the cord that I have running across a hallway.
Okay, we'll keep that in mind, for sure. We're going to make Ryan tweet us a picture of him in the bathroom. It's going to go at Leonard Lopate on Twitter and on our Facebook page, so everybody look for that. Okay. Got to ask you, Ryan, last night, what was it like to be in the audience when Hillary Clinton secured the nomination? I remember when she, you know, accepted it in Brooklyn. It was a very much more moving experience than I had anticipated. What was it like last night?
Well, as you probably saw from the TV images, well, two things. One, it was really interesting being in the room and not watching it on TV because, as you may have heard, the way they did it, they had all 50 states announced their vote totals, and that was really a something they did for the Bernie Sanders campaign because they wanted all of his delegates recorded, all of those delegates having a chance to sort of, you know, have their score recorded, but they weren't putting the total on the screen in the hall. And so technically, actually, you know, officially, it was, I believe, what, South Dakota that put her over the top, and on the TV networks who were doing the count on their own, when she hit a majority with South Dakota, they had the big breaking news, Hillary Clinton's the nominee. But inside the hall, there was no celebration when South Dakota went because there was no overall count, and they wanted the drama to be the very, very end.
Huh.
Vermont went, and Bernie Sanders surprised everyone by going down into the audience and speaking on Vermont's behalf and asking the convention to endorse her by acclamation. So kind of a weird thing. There was actually no celebration in the hall when she technically went over the top. But the rest of the evening was marred a little bit. The sort of unity celebration was certainly marred by quite a few Sanders supporters walking out and marching into the media tent. But inside, there were a lot of tears in the audience when after Bill Clinton spoke, I thought the end of his speech was very well done. Maybe the middle could have been tightened up a little bit. And then that sort of, you know, dramatic glass shattering that Hillary Clinton did, it was just emotional. It was the more emotion and intensity, both on the part of the Bernie Sanders delegates and the Hillary Clinton delegates, than anything you saw in Cleveland for anyone that was on stage in Cleveland. In Cleveland, it was just this lukewarm, all right, Trump's our guy. Here, it is the intensity is much, much different.
So is what you're saying, then, that it seems like in the last 48 hours, since the first day of the convention, that the party's attempt to unify, is kind of working? Does it feel like the rift is healing between the Bernie or bust people and the diehard Hillarys?
I mean, I have to say, I think that the TV networks, I think, frankly, have really not been paying as much attention as I think as I expected them to the holdouts. I interviewed the Vermont delegation, some delegates from Vermont yesterday afternoon, right before the roll call. Talked to three of them. All three of them were very, very lukewarm on Hillary Clinton. In fact, I talked to this young woman, 18 years old, Esther O'Leary. She was actually going to be the person who spoke on behalf of the Vermont delegation and announced their vote totals. that got changed when they decided to have Bernie Sanders do it. But she said something like, you know, and I have a piece at the New Yorker that has the exact quote, mm-hmm. something like, you know, I'm coming around to the idea of supporting Hillary Clinton. You know, so if you're the second day of the convention that's going, this is a young woman, right? The second day of a convention that's nominating the first woman at the top of a major party ticket, and you know, you still have people, you still have these, you know, Bernie supporters who are not haven't come around. I think they expected the convention to be more of a celebration of Sanders, I guess, was what they said. I was surprised that they expected that, to be honest. So I don't want to exaggerate how many people are like that, but the Sanders supporters, there are quite a few Sanders supporters that are still processing this, and I don't think you necessarily wouldn't get that from the pictures watching at home.
I mean, that's what's so fascinating about these two conventions, right? Having covered politics myself, oh God, 96, I was at the convention in Chicago. It was so boring. Bill Clinton was coming back in. I mean, please, you know, nothing.
Yeah, like, it was a boring reelection campaign.
Completely.
Yeah.
And this time you're talking about people on the floor, both in Cleveland and in Philadelphia, who are changing their minds as you are speaking to them. That is amazing.
Absolutely. And I, you know, just as we had Ted Cruz, I mean, the Ted Cruz drama in Cleveland was amazing. I mean, never before have you seen a prominent person like that get up there, give a speech and not endorse. We had a mini version of that here in Philadelphia where Shyla Nelson, a Vermont delegate, she was up there. And some of your listeners may, if they were watched yesterday, they will remember her as a delegate from Vermont who seconded Bernie Sanders. This was another thing that the Clinton campaign did for Sanders. They mm-hmm. allowed his name to be placed in nomination. That doesn't always happen. Mm-hmm. And this woman who from Vermont, who's known Sanders her whole life, seconded him on stage at the convention, was allowed to speak by the Hillary campaign, who's really running things here. And she went down into the audience, and as soon as Hillary Clinton was nominated, she helped lead the walkout of these dozens of delegates. And I don't know if you know the full story. They walked out. They sort of invaded is maybe too strong a word, but they sort of filed in large numbers into the media filing tent, which created a mini ruckus where you had all of these police suddenly rush to the scene because they weren't sure what was going on. And those officers sort of formed a line so that no one else could get into the media filing center. So it was like for a minute or two there, there was some serious drama. And this was all playing out while outside the arena. But anyway, Shyla Nelson, who was on stage a few minutes before, sort of became the spokesperson for that protest that lasted, you know, an hour or so with the Bernie supporters. And you know, I think it's worth today and tomorrow. There may be some you know, some scattered boos and some turned backs, and I don't think they're done protesting. And so, will this matter politically going into the fall? You know, maybe a lot of the polls show anywhere from 80% to 90% of Sanders supporters will back Clinton, but I think they've managed to give us in the media something to write about and to put a little bit of a damper on the unity message.
I'm Manoush Samarodi, sitting in for Leonard Lopate today. You are listening to WNYC and WNYC.org. And we're talking to Ryan Lizza. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker. You probably read his stuff all the time. But his most recent article is called "In a Bizarre Presidential Race, Gary Johnson Might Actually Have a Shot." Okay, but wait, before we get to Gary Johnson, because I do want to delve into that, can I just ask you about the speeches so far?
Yeah.
I thought, like, I gotta say, Michelle Obama for president, like 2024 or whatever the next one is gonna be, she was amazing on Monday night.
She was amazing. I've been to every convention since 2000, and that ranks up there with Obama's speech, which actually today is the 12th anniversary of Obama's famous speech from 2004 at the Democratic Convention in Boston. It ranks up there with, you know, some of Bill Clinton's finest speeches delivered. You know, Cuomo's famous speech. What I found so poignant about it was personal, right? I mean,
yeah.
She talked about her experience in this crazy job of being First Lady, and just the subtle references to what she and her husband have been through from the likes of Donald Trump, without mentioning Donald Trump's name, and the whole section about, you know, taking the high road when others go low. I mean, people were weeping in the on the floor of that convention.
Is that what it feels like, that the Democrats are finding a way to take the high road, whereas the Republicans last week were still feeling massive rifts? I mean, Ted Cruz not endorsing Trump during his speech.
Well, it is the weird thing at these conventions is there really is both, right? So you have this, you know, this inspirational speech like that, and you know, and others not of as high quality, but certainly plenty of them. And then right after that, you'll have a video with the doom and gloom music and Donald Trump's face in shadow, and you know, talking about how he's, you know, some of the bad things he's done in his life, people he's ripped off, you know, lies he's told. So there is, they're doing both, right? They're doing lots of positive messaging in the speeches, and then you know. It is, frankly, despite Michelle Obama's speech, it really is a mix of high and low. But it's politics; they've got to point out Trump's flaws. They have this massive national audience, and it's their, you know, you don't get an opportunity like this to speak to, you know, what is it, 30, 35 million people a night. So, I don't think Democrats at this convention or going forward will shy away from hitting Trump really, really hard. I mean, I think some Democrats are arguing they haven't been doing it enough. But the main difference, the main difference is the messages of these two conventions are just night and day. I mean, Trump's message, you know, I hope this doesn't sound overly partisan, but it's just factual. His message, it's a very us and them message, right? There's people that are in the circle of us. I think very interestingly in Cleveland, one of his, you know, he's tried to put gays and lesbians in the us category for the Republican Party in Cleveland, but he's got a whole list of other people who are in the them category, you know, Muslims, Mexican immigrants, sometimes African Americans,
right.
And that's the message that came out of there. Here it is 100% about inclusion. It's about togetherness. It's really about putting a spotlight on vulnerable populations in America, whether it's the disabled. A lot of emphasis actually on disabled Americans the last couple of days. Minority groups. You know, a celebration of Black Lives Matter rather than a condemnation. And you know, look out into the audience, and it's not all white. And you know, that's a huge difference between these two parties right now, is just how racially diverse the Democratic Party is, and how overwhelmingly white the Republican Party is. And you know, you see that. You know, we all know that because we read the statistics. But being here and talking to people, you get this raw sense of like two Americas. Frankly, I mean, that the irony of an Obama speech 12 years ago is that he was wrong, you know, when he talked about how there wasn't a Black America and there wasn't a white America and how there wasn't a blue America and a red America. And in a lot of ways, 12 years later, that, you know, it's just not true, right? And I think even he would admit that in a lot of ways now.
Okay, so away from the conventions, there are still a lot of people who are unhappy with either nominee, which brings us to your profile on Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate. What a fascinating guy. I knew none of this until I read your piece. The Libertarians had their convention in May. The theme was hashtag legalize freedom. Is that a double entendre, Ryan? Because your profile gave the impression that marijuana is an extremely important part of Gary Johnson's life.
Yeah, and I hope I didn't overemphasize that, but it's really, it's something he really cares about, right? It's something that he took a big risk on many years ago in pushing, and frankly, you know, he says this, I haven't been able to check if this is 100% true, but he says that he remains the highest elected American government official to be in support of marijuana legalization, which is kind of nuts in 2016. Like even Governor Hickenlooper in Colorado, who is overseeing legalization, is not in favor of it.
So
he's always been against it, but he's always said he'll obviously do it because that's what the voters chose.
And when you say highest elected official, again, I'm sorry, I can't help myself. The damn puns just keep coming.
That was not on purpose. And so so that you have all these plot points in his life. You know, he was a pretty, you know, he was a serious pot smoker when he was younger. When he was running for New Mexico governor in 1994, he actually quantified this, and he came up with the number. You know, he smoked pot about 2.5 times a week. I always thought it was kind of funny. Not two, not three, but 2.5.
And it's like I have two and a quarter kids or something like that.
Exactly.
It's like...
And he... he was silent on the issue through his first term, but in his second term, when you've passed re-election and you can use maybe be a little bit more brave politically, he came out for legalization, and it kind of sank him politically in New Mexico for a while, and he kind of, moved on from the issue, ended pretty popular, but the marijuana legalization cost him a lot of political capital when he was governor. But after he left the governor's office, that was like the issue he has sort of stuck with ever since, to the point where up until late last year, he was, I'm going to forget his title now, but I believe CEO of what they describe as a marijuana marketing company.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And that company is still active, and he still owns stock in it. And they're, from talking to him and others involved with the company, they're sort of poised to make some money as legalization sort of takes off, especially if California has legalization after November. So I was joking the other day. I was like, look, Gary Johnson is one of the only people in America that's either going to be president of the United States or enter the marijuana business.
Right. I mean, you're right about the fact that he tells you that he won't indulge in marijuana, as he calls it, if he becomes president. But then he also told you that he got high by eating Chiba Chews. I have to ask you, what are Chiba Chews?
All right, so I had the same question, and I'll tell you a funny story about this too. So Chiba Chews, as you can learn from a Google search, are a very popular brand of edible marijuana. I think they come in more than one flavor, but it's like a little, chocolate or whatever.
They sound delicious.
And there, I'm actually going to Aspen on Friday, so I will. I'll figure it out and report back.
Let us know.
I'm going to go to a conference there. Not like I go to Aspen.
I was just there, and I forgot to should have read your piece first.
But High Times has called it. What did they call it? They called it like one of the America's favorite edible or something. So it's like a popular edible brand that's legal for sale in Colorado. And the reason he told me he ate that is because I asked. He told me he's not consuming. He doesn't smoke pot anymore. He only does edibles. He said it's very rare that he would smoke because he's a serious athlete as well. But I asked him. He said he doesn't do it anymore because he's campaigning, and I asked him when was. So I just was pressing him for details on the last time, and that's the context by which the Chiba Chews came up. He was talking about him and his fiance, out for a night in Santa Fe. He thought it was, and they had some Chiba Chews. There's one other detail in the article that I pointed out that's, a little bit of a doesn't make him look so great. We're walking through this convention center, and someone mentioned Harriet Tubman, and for a second he didn't know who Harriet Tubman was, and he asked, who's Harriet Tubman? And so someone, after they read the article, joked to me, said, let me get this straight. He knows what Chiba Chews are, but not who Harriet Tubman is, and he wants to be president of the United States. And I thought that was a tough but fair a fair critique of him. I will say, probably one of the most likable, genuine, transparent politicians I've ever interviewed. The kind of person who you could sit there and ask any question, any personal question, and he would answer it. Someone who truly prides himself on this, on being transparent and not being a hypocrite. So, I came away from a couple of days with him, just admiring him as a politician, just because you come across so many phonies in this business.
We're talking about 2016 Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson with New Yorker staff writer Ryan Lizza. Ryan spoke with Gary Johnson for his profile piece, which is called In a Bizarre Presidential Race, Gary Johnson Might Actually Have a Shot. We've posted a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org/Lopate. And we're going to talk to Ryan some more after a break. I have so many more questions. I also want to tell you that we are currently taking your questions about giving and receiving apologies for New York Times Social Cues columnist Philip Galanis. He's going to be hosting the show tomorrow, and he will be taking your calls. So if you want to, get your question in early, if you've got one for him, you can start writing us right now on our show page at WNYC.org/Lopate. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, host of WNYC's podcast Note to Self. I'm in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org, and we will be back after a very quick break. I'm Anoush Samarodi, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. You're listening to WNYC and WNYC.org. And we are talking to New Yorker staff writer Ryan Lizza. He has a profile of Gary Johnson, the Libertarian presidential candidate. And that article is called "In a Bizarre Presidential Race, Gary Johnson Might Actually Have a Shot." And that's in the July 18th edition of The New Yorker. Okay, so Ryan, but let's be clear. Let's talk about what Johnson's chances are to be a presidential contender, realistically. You write that he is currently polling at 10%, sometimes 12%. Is there a magic number that he needs in order to participate in the debates with Secretary Clinton and Donald Trump?
There is, and this is everything for a third-party candidate.
Yeah.
And that's a 15%. The Presidential Commission, well, I guess it's called the Commission on Presidential Debates, which really is, you know, I mean, maybe controlled is too strong a word, but it's really linked to the two major parties. The third parties don't have much of a say over what they do. Anyway, they have a 15% threshold for third parties. And they haven't released the exact criteria or the exact polls they will use.
Yeah, well, how do they even decide? I mean, that seems like a very woolly number.
Exactly. And it'll be something like, you know, five polls or a polling average over a certain period of time. And I believe in past years they've actually identified the sort of credible national polling organizations whose polls that they'll look at. And that once they release the fine print about that, that will determine the fate of Gary Johnson and Jill Stein, for that matter, of the Green Party. But, you know, and it's going to be tough for Johnson because right before the two conventions, he was ticking up. You know, he was getting 9.
Mm-hmm.
The last poll I saw, one at 13. But a consistent upward trend for him when pollsters even throw his name in there. They don't always do it. But he's got 2 weeks now where he's been totally blocked out by the Republican convention and the Democratic convention. And these conventions tend to be, just historically, they tend to be consolidating events, right, where Republicans who are lukewarm about Trump come home, Democrats who are lukewarm about Hillary come home, and you very often see consolidation after the major party conventions, and that's partly what explains those bounces that candidates usually get out of their convention. So Trump got a bounce out of his convention, and you could see right away in the polling that it support for Johnson dropped. Hillary will probably get a bounce out of her convention, and that may further pull away some sort of Sanders supporters or libertarian-leaning Democrats who are on board with Gary Johnson. That may pull them back into the Democratic column. And so I think he's going to have a tough stretch here where the polls are going to show diminished support for him, and he's going to have to find a way in August, which is not exactly a great month for this, to get back into the media bloodstream. Because, you know, it's this chicken and egg phenomenon if you're a third-party candidate. You need media attention in order for the pollsters to take you seriously and in order for the American public to know who you are to hit that 15%. So his entire campaign right now is just media. He just needs media. He needs to be on TV. And if he gets to 15% and gets in the debates, I mean, then it is anything could happen. I mean, if he's on that debate stage, that's a, you know,
that would be pretty. I mean, do you think that would be good or bad? You spent time with Gary Johnson. I mean, he obviously can hold his own. But what do you
Absolutely.
Think? Would he put off Hillary and Donald? Like, would he sort of change the dynamic significantly?
Absolutely. I mean, I think personally it would be good. I think he's a good voice to have in that debate. It's, on the Republican side, you have a candidate that, you know, the faction of the Republican Party that really has problems, one of the major factions of the Republican Party that really has problems with Trump, are the Libertarians, right? I mean, they see Trump as an authoritarian.
Mm-hmm.
They see him having no interest in civil liberties. You know, they don't really see him as a constitutionalist. They think he's unpredictable. And so, you know, the Libertarian-leaning Republicans have a lot of problem with Trump, and you see a lot of prominent ones taking a hard look at Gary Johnson these days. And on the other side, as Johnson is very quick to point out, a lot of there are right libertarians and left libertarians. A lot of the left libertarians, especially in the Sanders orbit, like Gary Johnson more than Hillary Clinton, especially on civil liberties and foreign policy. They think she's too hawkish, and she thinks she's, in the post 9/11 world, has been too quick to go along with some of the intelligence, you know, some of the what they would argue are crackdowns on civil liberties. So he pointed this out, and it's true. In most of the polls that have been taken so far, he's actually drawn more from Hillary Clinton than from Donald Trump, which I was very surprised to learn.
That I am, too. I mean, especially since you talk a lot about in your piece about the effect of having the former governor of Massachusetts, William Weld, as his VP candidate. I mean, he is, that's pretty mainstream. Like, Weld is a big name in politics.
Yeah.
Why did he decide to join the ticket then?
Yeah, that was really interesting. And Weld is kind of a funny, waspy New Englander who, you know, he's got this very sort of casual approach to everything, you know, as if, you know, he as if he's not really, I'm not saying this is true, but his approach to everything is, you know, what, there's an Italian word called sprezzatura, which is, you know, a studied nonchalance.
Uh-huh.
I feel like that's Weld's approach to politics. It was all, you know, when I pressed him on it, it was almost like, you know, he was just didn't have, you know, why not? I like Gary Johnson, and this, it sounded like it would be a lot of fun. He wasn't really doing, he's working as a corporate lawyer, and I guess he thought this would be
boring.
A little more interesting. But he did, you know, and he, this, you get this a little bit more from Johnson, who is really outraged about Donald Trump and the Republican Party's positions on a number of issues, especially immigration. But I got it from Weld, too, to just the, you know, someone who for years has felt like an outlier in his own party, the Republican Party, going back to the late 90s when he was appointed or nominated to be Bill Clinton's ambassador to Mexico, and his nomination was scuttled by the very conservative Republican Senator Jesse Helms from North Carolina. And then, you know, that was the beginning of his sort of drifting away from the Republican Party. It ended, you know, basically ended his career, his government career. And he has, economically, when he was governor of Massachusetts, he was very libertarian. He was a tax cutter and budget cutter. And he's always been a social liberal. He's always been, he was fairly ahead of his time on a lot of issues, issues important that are important to the gay and lesbian community. He was very odd in the 90s to be a pro-choice Republican. He fought at one point, I believe in 96, to speak publicly at the Republican convention, the convention that you were at.
That's why he really stuck in my mind. I mean, he just seemed very reasonable.
Yeah, right. And then, and so he, and he, since they were two Republican governors in the 1990s and were both sort of out of step with their party on social issues, they got to know each other fairly well back then. And Johnson, I mean, I have to say, Johnson, he was almost giddy with excitement when he would talk about Weld, almost like a kid talking about a Christmas present.
Yay!
I mean, his last VP, I mean, I'm not trying to dismiss them or mock them, but his last VP candidate, you know, was not an not a prominent elected official. He was the he was a sort of anti-war on drugs crusader from California, former judge from Southern California. You know, he just didn't have the prominence that Weld brought to the ticket. And they did a 2-hour primetime town hall special on CNN.
Hmm.
And I don't think that would have happened unless Weld were on that ticket. You know, it's the two former governors. They've got that's a lot of. It's the most mainstream ticket the Libertarian Party has had in a long time.
Yeah, I don't think I quite realized how sort of fluid the lines are between, or porous between, the Republicans and the Libertarians, and that, like, David and Charles Koch, the leading Libertarians, like, why did they go over to the Republicans?
Well, that's what's really interesting. And so when you get into, like, when do third parties actually have an impact in American politics? This great line by Richard Hofstadter, you know, that third parties are like bees. They sting and then they die. And the reason that the two-party system has been so stable for so long is as soon as a third party comes along, they usually have to have some issue that the two main parties aren't addressing that seizes the attention of the public and builds them up. And then what immediately happens in the marketplace is the Republicans and or the Democrats co-opt that issue, and they make the sort of, you know, the raison d'etre of the third party just disappear. And so, for say the, you know, the last big third party in American politics was Ross Perot's Reform Party.
Yes.
Which was actually, technically, it was founded after his 1992 campaign. But Perot in 92 had this big issue, the federal budget deficit, right? He bought time on television, so he had the media exposure, and he educated the American people about deficits. And, you know, both the Republicans and the Democrats arguably didn't see that as a major issue that was resonating with the public. And what did Clinton and Bush do that year? They came up with their own deficit reduction plan. And even in the course of the campaign, Perot's numbers started to go down. There were other reasons as well. And so by 1996, just 4 years later, Perot was really no longer a force in American politics. The Reform Party sort of slowly withered away. And that's happened with, you know, the Dixiecrats in 1948,
right, yeah.
You know, they seize on these issues. It was a big explosion, but the two parties co-opted. So the libertarians are a little unique in that sense, in that...
Yeah, what's their issue?
Well, their issue is just less government in all aspects of life, right? They have a very clean, clear philosophy. And, you know, voters tend, you know, they get little spikes when it seems that either party is becoming too interventionist, whether in the American economy or abroad. And so they've maintained ballot access in all 50 states. They've been small but potent enough to keep ballot access. And that is the great question, is I don't know what the great single libertarian issue is of 2016 that they could sort of, you know, that could get Gary Johnson to the 15%, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't talk as someone with one single issue. You know, he has his own views on all the issues. So I think that's the trouble he
has. That's the trouble, for him, for
right?
sure.
Right, so left libertarians have generally found a reason to be in the Democratic Party, although with lots of caveats, and right libertarians, even like, as you mentioned, the Kochs, who once dabbled in the Libertarian Party as the vehicle for libertarianism, decided to move into the Republican Party, especially in the 70s and 80s with Reagan. And frankly, the Republican Party just became a much more libertarian party, especially on economics. So the Libertarian
right.
Party itself was
kind of unnecessary.
Exactly. And so I think that's a big challenge for Johnson, is articulating, all right, what's the big idea that he has that these two parties aren't addressing?
Okay, we have a minute and a half left, Ryan. I want to talk about tonight. Who's on stage at the Democratic convention?
Yeah, tonight's a big night. I mean, you've got a lot of big names. You've got the VP. You've got Joe Biden. You've got Tim Kaine, and of course, you've got President Obama on the 12th anniversary of his famous convention speech. And so I think it's going to, you know, usually the VP speeches are pretty much pure attack dog speeches. And so it'll be interesting to see how much Biden and Kaine go after Trump. And then, you know, I feel like every time that Barack Obama has sort of broken his silence over the last 2 years and dipped his toe into politics, he has had quite a bit on his mind, especially about Donald Trump. So
are there a lot of Democrats who are hoping he just brings it tonight?
I think so. I mean, it's I don't know if you remember, I think it was 2011, but right around there, Barack Obama gave one of those comedy speeches at one of those press dinners in Washington, and Donald Trump was in the audience, and the majority of his speech was just a roast of Donald Trump in fairly personal terms.
Right.
There are some people who think that all these years later, it caused Trump to run for president to get back at him.
But that's what you're saying, is that we're gonna time to put aside our own internal differences. Let's refocus. Let's move forward. Let's go for the jugular with Trump, because they were all over Hillary last week.
And I think Obama has two things to say. I still think there are some sore. I think there are some wounds that are festering here with the Bernie supporters. That's not over yet. And I think he'll probably have a message to them and to say, look, I fought a tough race against her. It wasn't easy for us to come together, but here's why you need to do it. So I think that'll be part of the message, and part of his case for Clinton will be, you know, this is someone I didn't always agree with, but I came to support her for these reasons. And I would assume some kind of reflections on her time as Secretary of State.
We've got to leave it there. I've been speaking with New Yorker staff writer Ryan Lizza. His profile of Gary Johnson is called In a Bizarre Presidential Race, Gary Johnson Might Actually Have a Shot. It's in the July 18th edition of the New Yorker. Ryan, this was so fun. Thank you so much.
Anytime. It was a great pleasure to be on.